Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are tuned in to another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Welcome one and welcome all to the RCP Halloween special episode. We're delighted to have you. In this extraordinary episode of Real College Podcast, we bring you three spine-tingling Radio K renditions of popular internet spooky stories, a look at Halloween during COVID, and another installment of Radio K Sports. A special thanks to SoundSnap for generously providing the sound effects used in this episode. Featuring almost 300,000 sounds and a library that is updated weekly, you can find your sound at soundsnap.com. Now buckle up and make sure you turn on a light. It's about to get sinister. Everything in this episode is as real or as unreal as you want it to be, so I invite you now to relax and listen to our first of three spooky stories. If you hear the ringing, performed by producer Emma Morris and reporter Isaac Maruyama.
My hometown has a bit of strangeness to it. Flatsville, located right off of Route 303, has a history to it of a rather sinister nature. We're a small-knit community of about 800 residents. Flatsville serves as more of a rest stop on Route 303, where truckers come in for cheap liquor and dusty old motels. There isn't a whole lot of business to find here, especially as an up-and-coming novelist. I'm now taking the time out to send some information, hoping someone out there can explain what the hell is going on in Flatsville. I first heard about the ringing in the fifth grade. Susie Watkins. We were in the same grade. She had strawberry blonde hair and rows of freckles on her nose. She was fairly well-liked, had great grades, and the social skills to match. When Susie passed, it was a shock to the whole town. At first, they thought it was an aneurysm. You know, you just collapse one day, dead as disco. Without any explanation or warning, just gone. Same thing happened with her, which made the aneurysm case so solid. What made the case stranger was Susie's mother started telling people about the ringing in her ear. Susie came home one day, complaining to her about a ringing in her ear. Thinking nothing of it, Susie's parents just cleaned out her ears and sent her off to play. Maybe they weren't trying to scare her. They had to have known about it. Susie complained each day after that, the ringing's intensity growing. Susie was missing school, complaining that she couldn't sleep because of the ringing. She couldn't concentrate, she'd feel nauseous, and even get violent at times. All of these symptoms, starting from the constant ringing. 2 weeks after she told her parents, Susie was found face first in her bowl of bloody Cheerios at the kitchen table. Now, this may seem like a one-off kind of story, but people dying after hearing ringing is no joke around here. What left everyone on edge after Susie died was how young she was. You never heard about a kid hearing the ringing. Normally it was adults, and even more often, the elderly, complaining of a persistent, high-pitched ringing, often intensifying as days go on. You start feeling dizzy, nauseous, blood may trickle out of your ear. Then you just collapse. Now, people will give you all kinds of excuses as to what causes the ringing. The most popular cause is an old nuclear power plant that was decommissioned sometime in the early 90s. People say that the radiation from the plant causes the ringing, and that the effects of the poorly planned decommissioning is still causing the ringing to this day. Personally, I only know two people who have died from the ringing, Susie Watkins and my old guitar teacher, Mitch. I used to go to his house for guitar lessons every Wednesday afternoon. He was 26 at the time, and I thought he was the coolest guy ever. During one lesson, he stopped playing mid-song. I was playing rhythm, and he was leading, when suddenly he stopped. He twitched his head to the side and jammed his pinky into his ear. "Everything okay?" I asked Mitch, but he just complained about it being some earwax. He continued playing, but then we ended the lesson shortly, saying that he couldn't focus. I didn't think too much of it until I saw him at the music store 6 days later. Mitch looked like he hadn't slept a wink. His face was pale, and his eyes had dark circles underneath them. He looked wobbly, on edge, kind of like someone was trying to sneak up on him. I tapped him on the back, and he nearly jumped out of his skin. Sorry, Mitch. Didn't mean to scare you. Find any good CDs today? He mumbled something incoherently, but I couldn't really understand what he was saying. Sorry, what? Can you say that again? I replied, but Mitch just stared at me blankly. Mitch? I called out. But again, he just continued to stare at me, hunching over as his mouth gaped open. I called out once more. Mitch, is everything okay? But this time, I took a step back. A trickle of blood dripped from his face, and he crashed onto the floor. I watched him, still as a statue, start bleeding from both of his eyes, but he didn't seem to notice as the blood raced down his face, almost like tears. I shrieked. A store manager, Andy, came running over after hearing me. Mitch fell to the floor, blood continuing to pour out of his eyes and now starting to seep from his ears. He felt cold, and his face looked like a skeleton, pale and unshaven. Mitch trembled in my arms as Andy called an ambulance. They loaded Mitch into the ambulance, but he didn't make it to the hospital. He died on the way there, the examiners calling it another aneurysm. We're the only town in America where you're more likely to have an aneurysm than anywhere else. I know what happened to Mitch. Hell, I think everyone does. It's just that no one likes to talk about it. It's all a big secret. Everyone just prays that it doesn't happen to them. I watched as the years go by, and more people each year seemed to die. What seemed like only a few people a year turned now into at least a dozen. Almost like it's been getting stronger. It's been a few days now. The ringing started on my way home from the gas station. I thought it was just an effect from listening to the music too loud in my car, but it hasn't stopped. Sleeping has been impossible these last two nights. I just lie awake, staring at the ceiling. The ringing seems like it's been getting louder. My head has been throbbing. It feels as if a drill is being forced deep inside my skull. There isn't enough Advil to take that would help it. I'm starting to get scared. There was blood on my pillow last night. Please, if anyone is out there that knows what the hell this is or how to treat it, please, I don't know how much time I have left.
To bring you a break from the tales of terror, I went on a hunt to find a little spooky spirit during the time of COVID. During my investigation, I naturally reached out to the most obvious sources I could find, the folks over at the Renaissance Grounds in Shakopee who run the Trail of Terror, and the lovely people over at Valley Scare. Unfortunately for me and my hopes of some good old-fashioned Halloween fun, both Valley Scare and Trail of Terror have gone into hibernation, with phone lines and emails both going unanswered. As I frantically searched for just a drop of fright on Halloween night, I got just what I needed from an albeit unlikely source.
My name is Chris. I've got five kids, and I don't take much credit, but they came up with most of the ideas. I think nobody knows really what's going to happen, and the little kids still want to trick-or-treat, and so everybody said, well, you just put a bowl out, and everybody takes one, but, you know, as the kids said, the first kids that come along usually just kind of dump the whole bowl into their bag, with a pillowcase, whatever, which is fine. We brainstormed some ideas, like a slide the candy down or throw it to them. The kids came up, they wanted to do a candy catapult that would fire the candy at the kids, but we kind of all agreed that, you know, the little ones might actually get injured. So we came up with the idea of we have two stone lions kind of on our front sidewalk. And so we're going to take like 12-foot sections of PVC pipe up from our porch, and then they'll go kind of next to the lion's mouth. And then the kids can come up, and then they can choose kind of like good or evil. The kids are still going to name the lion something. And then the kids can pick, and then we basically shoot the candy. I mean, it slides down. It'll come up kind of fast, but it slides down kind of more or less-ish out of the lion's mouth.
Flying candy is good, but I had to ask Chris what kind of candy we are talking about.
Yeah, so the kids are going to try to divvy it up. We're going to make it very different. So I don't know, it might be maybe like, you know, artificially fruit-flavored chewy candy out of one, maybe chocolate stuff kind of out of the other, or maybe like Red Hots or something. I don't know. That's we're working on that today and tomorrow.
In addition to airborne candy, I had to ask Chris what they had going on for decorations.
We decorate. You know, we put spiders up. We put a graveyard out. We put bones around. We have witches hanging. We got a strobe light with a scream on it when you open the door, but I don't know if we're going to be opening the door or not because we'll be down kind of on the sidewalk. Strobe light can make you kind of nauseous. What else do we have? I think that's about it. We got a whole bunch of little, we got like a little hand and a like palm reading kind of a thing and like a book of spells and stuff like that. And the kids carved like 9 pumpkins, which is a pile. They did those like 2 weeks ago.
Although I'm a college student with little to no intention of trick-or-treating, I had to ask Chris what was the word on the street. Is Halloween as we know it canceled?
I don't think anybody knows, which is weird. I don't think anybody knows. I was looking for some sort of direction from the governor or some sort of announcement, you know, from the mayor or somebody like, here's what our plan is. Because obviously we got, I mean, our kids are, they're 13 to 17. We're skewing a little bit older, but you know, the kids want to get out. So I don't know. I've noticed not as many houses are decorated. There's a street like 3 blocks from us on Palace that I think they literally get a couple of thousand kids every year on that block. They close off the street and every single house, if you move there, they have a little conversation with you and you have to participate whole hog. You know, they have the dry ice and cemeteries and smoke machines and bonfires and flying saucers like that have crashed into roofs. And I haven't driven over there. But they usually wait literally till like 2 days before Halloween. So I have to go check it out tomorrow. So I don't know. I think I've seen fewer decorations, but I'm not sure what everybody's going
to
do.
Although I was grateful to Chris for giving me my spooky season fix, my appetite was far from sated. In search for more ghouls and goblins, I called up Ashley Ryan, the marketing director over at First Avenue, as I had heard tell that they are reopening just in time for their annual Halloween party and costume contest.
So normally, in years past, Halloween would have been a big dance party, and that won't be this year, which is definitely going to feel a little bit different, but we just thought there's still an opportunity for people to get dressed up and put costumes on and you know, safely and in small numbers, enter the costume contest, get their photo taken, you know, and have a good time. This will be, you know, like you said, our first event back. We haven't had any live music, you know, no DJs, nothing like that. And it's been a very strange 7, almost 8 months because of it. You know, First Avenue has never really been so quiet.
Ashley went on to describe the vibe of First Ave on Halloween night.
Because it's been closed for so many months, you know, it's pretty clean. There's no spilled beer on the floor or anything like that, but it will be decorated, yes. It'll still have the spooky vibes. You know, there'll be the lights down and cool lighting, like ambient lighting and holiday decor like we would typically have. You know, I hope you get the same feeling when you walk into First Avenue as you normally do, excited for a fun night. I think that building has such character and so much history that just walking in there, you kind of feel something special no matter what.
An annual tradition, First Ave's costume contest is a popular attraction. Ashley explained how the contest would be taking place while following COVID guidelines.
We do that every year. There's a photo booth that you go get your photo taken in. And that's actually every year the way that you enter the costume contest. So that hasn't changed too much, but so you'll get your photo taken, and then a select group of judges will determine the winners, which is, again, the same thing that we do every year. And, you know, the big difference will be this year we don't bring those winners on stage in front of people and get, like, the crowd applause to help us determine, because don't think that's probably the best way to do it this time around. So we'll determine it, and then those folks will get notified, and we'll include them in our newsletter so people will be able to see after the fact the costumes and who won.
Ashley noted how much effort contestants put into their costumes.
People hand make their costumes. Like, it's not a lot of store-bought stuff. It's all, like, people who are, like, paper macheing and, like, decoupaging their own costumes. It's really cool.
In addition to making Halloween a scary night for us all, it's a scary time for First Avenue. I asked Ashley what the future looks like for the historic venue, as well as ways for fans of the landmark to get involved.
We don't have any sort of open-to-the-public events on the calendar right now. I mean, stuff is in the works, but nothing to plug except for the fact that we are open for private events right now. So we're doing weddings at First Avenue. People can come get married at First Ave or host, like, private small group events as well. So that's kind of it. We've got some live stream stuff coming up, but we will be working on, you know, having more events that we can let people know about. And then in terms of what the future looks like, it's just totally unknown. It's, you know, with Congress kind of sitting on this next level of aid and support for the whole country, we're kind of tied up in waiting for that as well. We're music venues, not just us, all music venues and art community, art theaters have been affected by this in a way that a lot of other businesses maybe haven't been, right? Like, we were some of the first to close. We'll definitely be the last to get to, like, fully reopen, whatever a normal, you know, reopening would look like. And it's just really devastating. So the thing that I'm asking, or that we're asking people to do, is go to this website. It's saveourstages.com. And you can, in like 30 seconds, write a letter to your representative telling them, hey, I still care. We want to see action for these like arts and music businesses that are just kind of sitting here waiting for the world to, you know, go back to normal.
Before we return to more spooky RCP content, here is Ashley with some final words of kindness and some more information on how to get involved with First Ave.
We miss everyone. We can't wait to, you know, get to see all of your smiling faces and hear some music together. You know, and I would say the two best ways that you could support First Avenue right now, I know, you know, times are tough for everyone. So, like I said, that saveourstages.com website where you can very quickly and easily let your representatives know you support live music. And then, you know, if you want to shop local for the holidays, buying from the First Avenue merch store on our website is also another great way to support us right now.
In our next terrible tale, we will hear from producer Annabelle Ludwig in her performance of Why Quit Dating Apps. Enjoy.
Today I'm going to tell you the story of why I stopped using dating apps. I've always been a bit paranoid about meeting strangers. Maybe it was all the true crime podcasts, so I avoided internet dating like it was the plague. That is, until the actual plague hit, and I got lonely. Quarantine lonely was hitting different, like a brutal hangover. Gone were the days when I could expect to stumble into a DIY show each weekend and stumble back out with a mustachioed man offering me an American spirit, so begrudgingly, I downloaded Tinder, then Hinge, and Bumble. A whole suite, if you will. I got really into swiping, and I added a Bjork song to my profile. Listen, I don't claim to be a genius, but I'm certainly not stupid. I wouldn't meet up with anybody until I felt comfortable, until I felt like I knew them at least enough to make an informed judgment, so when someone I actually knew in real life came up on my screen, I was stoked. I knew him. I went to high school with him, so what could be the harm? I swiped right on his picture, and I put my phone down to brush my teeth. The screen lit up like 20 seconds later, and he matched me back. My first emotion was surprise. I mentioned that I'd known him, but mostly from afar. I went to the kind of suburban high school where kids drove Land Rovers, and he was one of those. I didn't think he'd ever notice me, and I certainly didn't think he'd be into someone like me. As soon as I'd seen we'd matched, another notification came in. A message from Spencer. Before I knew it, we were chatting late into the night. He seemed decent. And he listened to Radio K. Finally, I told him I had to get some sleep. It was almost 3 in the morning. And he asked me if I'd like to meet the next evening for a date. He said no pressure, of course. So I said sure. We met at one of the rooftops on Hennepin, and we caught up over dinner and drinks. He'd gone to the U, too, before taking what sounded to be a very silly consulting position. He was doing well. He'd grown up, but just like me, he was lonely now. Spencer paid the bill, but I tried to split it. At the end of the night, he asked if I'd like to go back to his place. Same line. No pressure, of course. I was probably a bit tipsy because I accepted. Normally, I wouldn't dream of it, not out of some idea of what a good girl should do, whatever that even means, but because I didn't feel I could trust anyone so quickly. But again, I knew him. Felt like I knew him, I guess. We went to the liquor store on 9th, and he let me pick out a little six-pack of ciders. He held the door of the Uber open when it picked us up, and he opened it again when we got to his house. It was a nice condo, of course. He handed me an open cider, and we hung out on his couch for a while, just talking, sipping our drinks. About an hour later, there were 6 abandoned cider bottles on the coffee table, but we were not in the living room. It was good. It wasn't great. I mean, is it ever really great the first time with somebody new? Afterwards, I started to cram my foot into one of my heels, but he stopped me.
Stay the night. Let's just talk for a while.
That caught me off guard. In a good way. So I said yes. And that's when things started to get weird. Spencer started to tickle me. Normally, I'd be really annoyed, but he was cute enough to pass it off, and it seemed like maybe we were about to go for round 2. Until he pinned me onto the bed and not in a fun, round 2 kind of way. He stared at me, and then he blinked, and then he stared again.
I don't want to hurt you,
is what his words said, but his actions were just to press me into the mattress further. He must have seen that I was scared, so he let me go. He was back to the lighthearted, funny, sweet guy I'd just gone to dinner with. We told some more stories for a while, and I'd almost forgotten about that one seemingly offhand strange moment when he did something weird again. Spencer stared off into the distance for a moment, as if he was listening to or waiting for something. I lost my train of thought and I trailed off. He slapped himself. Not hard, but still. What? And muttered to himself.
Knock it off.
That old paranoia started to kick in, but I didn't want to be the one to make it weird, so I let him pull me in closer and give me a forehead kiss. I thought it felt nice. I was close to falling asleep, too. In fact, I was nearly in La La Land when he did it again. He knocked his head into the headboard. A little harder than he'd struck himself earlier, but not so hard he'd hurt himself. It seemed like maybe he was trying to jolt himself out of some sort of intrusive thought, like how sometimes I catch myself thinking about putting my hand down the garbage disposal, if only for a split second.
If you don't cut it out, I'm gonna have to call the police.
Baby, I'm gonna run to the bathroom, is what I said, and I tried not to run, but I ran. I could no longer ignore how afraid I felt. I realized that regardless of however sweet he'd been all night, my heart was beating out of my chest. I was in a virtual stranger's house. Nobody even knew where I was, and I didn't feel safe. He seemed like he was battling with something internal, and while I completely understand that doesn't inherently make somebody dangerous, in fact, if he was hearing voices or something like that, he'd actually be more likely to be victimized himself than to hurt me. So I splashed some cold water on my face, and I tried to convince myself that everything was fine, that I was okay. But all of that went out the window when just seconds later I heard this huge noise from the bedroom. And then, like these shuffling sounds of a physical struggle, but Alan was the only one in the room. And I didn't want to be in that room anymore. I slipped out of the bathroom, moved quickly on my tiptoes into the living room, and then I held my breath as I cracked the condo door open. I exploded into the night in my bare feet. My shoes, left behind, were the farthest thing from my mind when I heard,
"Where are you? Where the fuck are you?"
He looked for a few minutes, but he never found me. I was lying beneath a car on the street, frozen in abject terror. Once I was convinced he'd given up on his search, I ran down the street, called an Uber, and never looked back. He tried to contact me again, tried to put on that sweet facade again, but I wasn't having any of it. The vitriol in his voice as he shouted after me was so intense, so primal, that I knew how he really felt about me. He was a predator, and I was his prey. After escaping that night, I felt lucky. I relayed the story to my girlfriends over numerous drinks and anxious laughter the following weekend, boasting that I'd dodged a bullet with Spencer, that he was not right in the head, and that I lost a good pair of heels but saved myself a lot of grief. Years passed, and I didn't think of that night any further. That is, until Spencer was tried for murdering one of his dates. The prosecution alleged that he chucked her off the roof of his parents' mansion, but he insisted she was a lunatic. He claimed she was drunk and had been acting erratic all night, so crazy and so hysterical that she jumped herself. He said he'd tried to help her, tried to stop her, but she was dangerous and aggressive. To prove his point, he handed over an audio recording of the hour leading up to her death. "You never know what you might get accused of these days," he claimed. "Best to cover your bases, right?" He was acquitted. Got off on all charges. Got away with no consequences. To his credit, it did sound like she was behaving oddly. I've listened to it 100 times over. I've heard the sounds of blows falling. I've heard him tell her, a little too clearly, if you ask me, to knock it off. Cut it out. He even tells her that if she doesn't stop,
I'm gonna have to call the police.
But I know the truth. I know that he did it, but I can't prove it. And I know that I was lucky to have escaped that night. I didn't see it myself, but it's clear to me now that Spencer was recording our date that night. He wasn't hearing any voices. He wasn't trying to silence intrusive thoughts. He wasn't talking to himself at all. He wasn't even talking to me. He was performing for the jury of my future murder trial. I'm Annabelle Ludwig, and you're listening to RCP at Radio Kai.
Hold on. Tiptoe. Pockets don't fat like a hippo. I turn white to a widow. Bro just got blood on his new coat. Damn.
Wow, that was an intense one. Luckily, we have a break from the more sinister thanks to the K-Sports Hour. Here, back with another installment of K-Sports Hour, our Trask and Grant.
Hello, everybody. My name is Trask Angel alongside Grant Sandberg. And for this week on Real College Podcast, we decided to look into the behind the scenes of Gopher football, what they do on a day-to-day basis that the public eye is not aware of. And so we decided to bring in someone from the athletic training department, a student intern named Simon, who's going to give us some more insights onto how that works and what he does and how he's involved with that Gopher football team. Please enjoy.
All right, we welcome on now Simon Solhide. Simon works with the Gopher football team. Simon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Pretty good. So first off, for people who aren't sure, what do you do with the Gopher football team?
I am a student athletic training intern. There are about nine of us that work with the team. We're just students here at the university. And we go in every day and kind of hang out with the training staff and help them out and do a bunch of stuff in the training room with them.
And how did you get into that? Was that something that you like applied for freshman year for people interested in doing something like that?
Yeah, so it's actually a really funny story because I saw it on Twitter. The like main Gopher football account tweeted out a little graphic that was like, attention, athletic medicine, like prospective students, like, they had a bunch of openings and I just sent an email and then I had a phone interview a couple weeks later and then I ended up getting one of the spots that they had.
Awesome.
So you mentioned athletic medicine. So how does this job translate into future goals, career aspirations for you?
So this is kind of the field that I am pursuing. I'm a kinesiology major and I'm thinking either like athletic training or physical therapy with that. So this is good. I'm getting a lot of experience in a great environment to learn a lot. Like I go there every day and I learn something new basically every day. And it's a lot of fun too. And it doesn't like feel like something I dread doing. I really enjoy doing it. And it's helping prepare me because I'm getting a lot of experience out of this.
And when you go in, you know, every day and stuff, you said you're working mainly with the trainers. So are you kind of they're walking you through what processes they're going through or how are you like assisting them?
Yeah, so we do a lot in the training room with like helping guys do rehab exercises because a lot of the guys come in like at the same time and there's not enough people to like help all of them at the same time. So we'll kind of help out with that. We'll do like, we'll tape like ankles and wrists before games and practices, stuff like that. And then we also do all the water and Powerade at games and practices.
Okay. So you talk about, you know, what you're doing there and, you know, how much time you're spending there. So is this something that, you know, you could see yourself pursuing like this? You could see yourself turning around and working at a D1 college doing this kind of thing, or you're thinking you want to be in physical therapy exclusively, or, you know, what exactly has this job shown you and pushed you into a certain career path?
I'm still kind of undecided which direction exactly I want to go, but I can definitely see myself doing this in the future, but I could also see myself doing physical therapy in the future. It's kind of a 50-50 right now for me. I'm not really sure exactly, but absolutely I could picture myself continuing doing this as a career.
Obviously, you can't talk about the specifics of how COVID and stuff is working on the football team. But in terms of just how your job has changed with COVID since it got shut down and then you're back, how is, and all the new implementations for health purposes, how has that changed what you do on a daily basis?
I can't speak to it a ton because I wasn't really there last year. Like I started in the spring, but then everything got shut down. I was there for like two practices of spring ball. So I can't really speak to it a ton, but we have to wear masks all the time, obviously. They're really tough on that with everyone, players included. And then social distancing, obviously, we have to social distance as much as possible. And we have to be very careful with the waters. We have to squirt the waters in their mouths. Us, like, they can't take the bottles themselves because then a lot of people are touching it. They might like put it in their mouths. They might do whatever with it. So we have to be the ones that do it because we know that they can't, it can't like go in their mouth. They can't be touching it. So then it's just limited to us. And then we disinfect them immediately after practice. But other than that, I mean, I can't like really get into how much more there is because I really just don't know.
And so, you know, with COVID, with everything that's going on at the athletic department, are you interacting with any other student employees, interns from other fields, say nutrition or something like that, that are also working with these teams? Or is it pretty much divided up into you're in your respective field and then the players kind of move on and work with those other people? Or is there, you know, is there cross-disciplinary action there?
Well, everyone with like the football team is all in the same building. So I do like get interaction with the equipment staff and the nutritional staff. Like we see them around. We talk to them a little bit, but everyone's kind of all for the football team in the football building. So everyone's kind of all together.
Awesome. Well, Simon, thank you so much for coming on. And it was great to hear your perspective. And I'm sure the listeners will love to learn more kind of about the behind the scenes of Gopher football and being an athletic training intern. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Really enjoyed it.
In our final radio play of the RCP 2020 Halloween special, we will hear from volunteers Frank Savage and Veronica Nowakowski in their performance of The Man Who Narrates My Life.
There's a man who follows me around and narrates my life. And he's starting to say some unsettling things. I've never seen his face. Always his back. He wears a black trench coat with a popped collar, so all I can really see is the top of his head and part of his black boots. He doesn't respond when I talk to him. He just stands a few feet away from me at all times, his back to me, narrating my entire life, and no one else can see him.
Veronica wakes up and rolls over in her bed.
Don't you have anything new to say? Whatever, I'm ignoring you now. What should I have for breakfast? Creepy man, any input? Breakfast burrito it is.
Veronica has innocently chopped in cilantro without any knowledge that she's in grave danger.
What? Shit, my finger.
Veronica cut herself and her blood oozes out, pleasing the one who watches. Veronica rolls over, closing her eyes, peacefully laying in her bed. What she doesn't know is that she will soon face a horrible fate that will end in her death.
I open my eyes, sitting up and looking over at his silhouette, slightly lit by the moonlight. I waited a few minutes, and he said nothing else, and I eventually fell asleep. I woke up the next morning as my alarm went off.
Veronica wakes up and rolls over in her bed. One day closer to her inevitable death.
I got up, walking into the bathroom and slamming the door shut, annoyed and a little bit scared. What's going on? He never said anything weird before.
Veronica washes her face. What she doesn't seem to realize is that it's much easier for someone to attack when her eyes are closed.
He's standing right behind me. The rest of my week went pretty similar, normal narrations for the most part, with some creepy stuff sprinkled in.
He is coming for her very soon. It is unavoidable. Veronica must die.
I barely slept, fearing that sometime in the middle of the night, someone would be performing spontaneous surgery on me. I put a knife in my bedside drawer and pepper spray under my pillow.
Veronica has been feeling anxious, as she should. Veronica's days are numbered. The one who watches is a rightful choice. The one who watches is very excited to kill. There will be no escape, only death. Veronica Veronica brushes her teeth for the last time. Tomorrow, she dies. Veronica choked on the mouthwash, feeling like she was dying, but it is not her time yet. Her time is tomorrow.
I managed to catch my breath and walked over to my bed, crawling in, leaving the lamps on. The last thing I needed was to be woke up at midnight and have to fight off a killer in the dark. I'm still alive? I walked into the bathroom and grabbed my toothbrush. I squeezed out some toothpaste to brush my teeth, put the toothbrush in my mouth. I looked up into the mirror, at my reflection, and then I froze. I spit into the sink and looked around my bathroom. I stuck my head into my bedroom and looked around there as well. I made my way through every single room in my house, but he was nowhere to be seen. He was gone. 25 years following me around and narrating my life, and now suddenly, when I was supposed to die, he just disappeared. I can't shake this feeling that I'm definitely gonna die. What did that even mean? I've spent my entire day in this kitchen. I figure there are more exits here as well as weapons. I'd probably be safer here than any other small room in the house. I got up and walked into the living room, walking up to the door and peering out of the peephole. It was him. He was standing on my porch, with his back to me as usual. I didn't move. I didn't breathe, as I just watched him standing there. I can hear him mumbling through the door. He's still counting down, and I've got about 20 minutes left. I can see that it's getting darker and darker outside as he counts down, even though it's not 3 o'clock in the afternoon yet. Every time I look out the window, something disappears. A house on my street, a car, a tree. Whenever something vanishes, it's replaced with darkness, and he keeps counting down. This might be my last chance at communication. I'm going to die today.
That's all for the Halloween special episode of RCP. Stay spooky, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.